Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. We'll get started right after this.
I mean, if you didn't have leaking, the newspapers would just be full of long lens bikini shorts and adverts for sheds and offers to buy three pairs of trousers for tenner, etc. It's the way it is.
That's just the way it is. As the thick of it's Malcolm Tucker knows, Westminster basically runs on leaks. Hundreds of journalists in the lobby will wine and dine ministers, MPs, staff, I mean literally anyone who'll give us the goss. And there's plenty of people willing to oblige. There are the little leaks divulged on WhatsApp. There are the big leaks disclosed on walks. There are the snippets shared over lunch. And there are the full-on massive document dumps. This week, I heard about them all. I heard about the leaks that brought down cabinet ministers, got people arrested, and even ones that helped to swing elections. I spoke to leakers, leakies, and the victims of leaks. I heard what it means for an administration when the leaks get too much. And I tried to find out why people leak when there's so much at stake for them personally. Seriously, some of the things I was told this week sounded like they'd come straight out of a John le Carré novel. And perhaps unsurprisingly, this episode does get a bit sweary.
I would go in effectively disguised every day.
Your heart beating faster, you're astonished that you're working on this thing, you're paranoid.
I had a phone call and the officer said, "We've got the police in here, they're trying to find you."
I remember once meeting a contact and they just handed me this giant bunk of information.
I do remember that when I got back on the coach, I did slump into my chair and, you know, say, "For fuck's sake."
From Politico, I'm Aggie Chambray, and this week on Westminster Insider, I'm discussing the art of the leak and asking, why do people do it? And what happens when your political secrets are exposed? ...2017 may well be etched into your brain as the year Theresa May called her disastrous snap general election after going on a walking holiday with her husband Phil. The opposition Labour Party was then led, of course, by Jeremy Corbyn, probably the most left-wing politician ever to lead a major political party. The dividing lines ahead of that election day seemed pretty clear. Until...
The draft of Labour's general election manifesto has been leaked.
The entire Labour manifesto had leaked 4 days before the party was due to unveil it, right in the thick of the 2017 election campaign.
Now, it contains policies on nationalising the railways, abolishing tuition fees, and it also reveals a pledge of £6 billion of extra funding for the NHS.
Labour's entire manifesto launch, their entire PR strategy, was blown apart. Nothing like this had ever happened before.
The origin of the leak was completely unexpected in the sense that I had been to a party, an event that I never dreamed would elicit a big story. Not for a second.
This is Jack Blanchard, my Politico colleague and longtime editor of this podcast, who I somehow managed to bag an exclusive interview with.
I went along because it'd be fun. And as you do at these events, you end up, you know, with a drink in your hand, talking to different people, you meet new people. I'm obviously not going to tell you who they were. I'm not even going to say what the party was because I have to protect my sources. But I met someone at that party who I'd enjoyed chatting to them. We kept in touch. On the 11th of May 2017, I was sitting in the Mirror's Westminster office in the House of Commons with a few colleagues in there. This person got in touch with me and said, "Do you want the manifesto?" And I said, "The whole manifesto?" And they said, "Yeah, and I'm going to email it to you right now." And I sort of sat down, and then an email popped up in my inbox, and I opened it, and it was the Labour Party manifesto. My jaw hit the floor. I called the source back and I said, "This really is the manifesto?" And they said, "Yes, it really is the manifesto." and I'm leaking it to you.
How are you feeling in that moment? I literally have sweaty palms just hearing you talk about it.
Your heart beating faster, you're astonished that you're working on this thing, you're paranoid that someone's going to find out about it, that maybe it's like some, I don't know, false flag thing. You've got a responsibility to get the story right when you've been leaked something like that.
Quickly, Jack's attention moved to how to land it.
There's a time pressure because it's journalism. I was working for a newspaper. I've got a deadline. The deadline's normally about 7 o'clock in the evening. This was sort of early afternoon, I think, when I got it. And I was like literally looking at the clock thinking, I've got 4 hours here.
Who's the first person you told?
My news editor, Tom Carlin, at the Mirror. I phoned and I said, got a massive story, Tom, a proper massive story. Got the whole manifesto. And he's like, fucking hell, mate.
After that, Jack rang someone he trusted in Labour HQ to verify the manifesto. And then...
I called James Schneider. James was Jeremy Corbyn's director of strategic comms, someone I knew extremely well. And he said,
hey, what's up?
And I said, James, I've been leaked the entire manifesto and we're publishing it tonight.
I remember it well. We were touring around South Yorkshire and I think we were at a rally, I think it was Rotherham, and I got a call from Jack Blanchard and he said, oh, hi mate, I've got the whole manifesto.
And there was just this long silence on the phone and he just said, of course you have.
I said, what, Oliver? He said, yes. I said, of course you have.
There was no shouting, there was no beseeching me, there was no yelling.
I said, we don't comment on leaks. We'll launch our manifesto on Tuesday, slightly on autopilot.
There was just someone who took a very deep breath and very calmly watched his entire world change in a second. And he said,
I think I better call you back.
I was pretty calm because that's just the mode in which you have to operate in. But I do remember that when I got back on the coach, I did slump into my chair and you know, say, for fuck's sake.
Do you remember telling Jeremy Corbyn?
Yes, yes. He wasn't best pleased about it. He doesn't get angry very often, but he was, you know, clearly very unhappy at that.
My recollection is that they then actually tried to put some pressure on my editor, Lloyd, not to publish, which he resisted.
That was what we were trying to do for about, you know, 15 minutes, half an hour, or trying to do a deal in some way. As you know, the grubby way political journalism often works is, oh, well, you've got this thing, well, we'll do a deal with you on this, blah, blah. Maybe half an hour later, I got a call from Kate McCann, who was then at the Telegraph, telling me that she also had the manifesto, at which point I said, I'll have to call you back so that I could call off any efforts we were making, trying to stop the story from the Mirror and then change that into engaging with them.
You would have expected it to be a total catastrophe for their election campaign. Because they took ownership of it, because they leaned into it, and frankly, because policy by policy, they were actually quite popular. It went really well for them. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure they stayed up pretty late working out what the hell to do.
We were up until, I think, 3 a.m. doing a briefing call.
I think that is all credit to the way that they handled this extraordinary leak and what should have been a disastrous crisis for them.
It was fully glorious. It was really fantastic because the manifesto got way more attention than it would have done otherwise. It was the story on Thursday night, so into Friday's papers. On Friday, we had the Clause 5 meeting where we confirmed it. Then we had the weekend, then there was Monday, then on Tuesday morning, we were launching it. So in effect, we got 5 days of outsized media coverage about our manifesto, which is what we actually wanted to do. And it was basically the best way the manifesto could possibly have been launched.
And I'm very proud to present our manifesto for the many, not the few. Thank you very much.
There were people in the lobby, certainly, who rather cynically assumed that I had been given this by Corbyn's people as almost like an intentional leak. There were certainly plenty of people who would just come up to me the following week and say, great story, they just gave you that, didn't they?
I wish I were that brilliant. I wish I were that brave. But no, it wasn't me. It was done in a hostile way in order to undermine us.
There are obviously loads of different reasons why people leak. And this, the hostile factional leak, is just one of them. There's also the honourable leak. This is where you truly believe the information needs to get out there. Then there's the accidental leak. This is pretty self-explanatory. One of my favourite recent examples of this was a shadow cabinet minister who accidentally told journalists something and it made it to the front page. And then there's the authorised leak. To the untrained eye, this may look like a leak, but it's usually just an attempt to get a policy announcement a better showing. And finally, there's this reason, explained best to me by a relatively chatty staffer telling me about the first time they'd leaked. They were in a local party meeting and the result of a vote was announced. They leaked the results and a journalist tweeted it. The staffer told me, and look, I am quoting here, that it was the biggest fucking buzz ever. And so there's also that. The I did it because it gave me the biggest fucking buzz ever leak. I have to say, it does seem like the more febrile the times, the more those on the inside become inclined to leak. It stands to reason then that the period of Jeremy Corbyn plus Brexit, not to mention Boris Johnson, made all of Westminster just a little bit leakier.
The thing that changed everything and changed my career as a journalist and changed everything in the way lobby works was Brexit.
This is Stephen Swinford, political editor at The Times. He's been in the lobby since 2013.
That is the moment that things politically really started to fall apart and that people started to go with their consciences. You had the cabinet completely split. You had splits all over Labour. And suddenly people were acting out of their own kind of personal political interests in a way that they weren't before.
Now, if you've sat down and drew a graph of Westminster leaks in the last few years, you'd probably find Swinford has been the recipient of a fair old chunk of them.
Do my best.
Was there a specific story where you were like, this is now a different era?
I started during the Brexit years to get what I would call 360-degree readouts of cabinet. And you started to get all of these different people around the table expressing different views, and cabinet readouts suddenly became exceptionally valuable. And the way that you get those readouts is something that's true to a lot of leaks to this day. In, you know, in my dreams as a journalist when I was growing up, you might imagine someone just gives you all the information in a darkened car park and that's it. It's not really how it works. How it works is you speak to someone who tells you something interesting, you speak to someone else, and you have this chain of people that you talk to. And only at the end of that chain do you get a full picture. If you speak to 10 to 15 people, you can verify what's been said. So my methodology as a journalist is really simple. I just call as many people as humanly possible on a daily basis. I probably make between probably around 30 or 40 calls a day.
Sometimes during those Brexit days, the leaks and hostile anonymous briefings from Cabinet came literally within minutes of the meetings ending.
The Cabinet was regularly leaked by more than one member of the Cabinet, which was obviously really annoying.
One of those sitting in that leaky Cabinet was Damian Green, then Deputy Prime Minister to Theresa May.
But actually has a significant damaging effect on government. Because if you can't have an honest discussion in cabinet, then people won't say things that they ought to say. And you know, getting a sense of a meeting when half the people there are not saying what they think because they don't want it to be leaked, and the other half are planning to leak it. You have to be secretive if every time you share a secret, somebody leaks it.
In late 2020... with the COVID pandemic still dragging on, Swinford got one of his most monumental stories, that Britain was about to go into a second lockdown.
It was very late on a Friday, and I was sitting at my desk in our bedroom, and someone said that there'd been a meeting, and then I'd started to put in some more calls about this meeting between Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock and others. And then as I put in more calls, I discovered that a decision had been made, and then I looked at what was going on, and there had been a discussion about whether it's going to second lockdown. And then I switched to some more people, and by the end of that, which was the product of many conversations, we ended up with an exclusive front page story that Boris Johnson was about to put Britain into a second lockdown, something that was going to affect millions of people. And it was, I remember being a really surreal moment, because I came out of my bedroom, just written the story and sent it off. I'd had the editor screaming for the copy. And then I just went downstairs and I said to my wife, I think we're about to go into national lockdown again.
From Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home.
There was subsequently a massive hunt for the Chatty Rat.
The Chatty Rat was the name of one of the many leak inquiries commissioned to find out who was giving away secrets.
Various people think they know who the Chatty Rat was. They think they know who the source of that story was. But actually, it was many people and many conversations. And that's typical of the way that things often work in Westminster. The leaks that I always delighted in is whenever the Prime Minister would say at the beginning of a cabinet, you are categorically not to leak any of this information on pain of death, or something similar. I remember Theresa May warning it, and there is a joy in reporting that they have made those warnings.
What do you think it means for a leadership and an administration when people are very leaky?
I think it makes it difficult. I think that there is a propensity to do very aggressive leak inquiries, and they think it's a sign of dysfunction. Oddly, I think it can sometimes be a good thing because it's a sign of debate. As a journalist, I think that public scrutiny of policy formulation, of things that are going to affect millions of people, is right. And I think that during COVID, there wasn't enough of it.
One of Swinford's other incredibly consequential scoops was that Theresa May's government had given the green light to allow the Chinese firm Huawei to help build the UK's 5G network, despite warnings from cabinet ministers and the US government.
Good evening. The Prime Minister has sacked the Defence Secretary, accusing him of leaking information from a meeting of the National Security Council last week.
After the conclusion of a formal leak inquiry, Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson was sacked from his role.
It's limited what I can say about it, but I can say it involved talking to lots of people. And there was a major leak inquiry into it. I remember watching all of that unfold and the drama of his sacking, and I obviously remember it vividly. I think I'd just turned my phone off by that stage and I tried to kind of disengage from it because the heat was so much over it. I felt that there was a significant blowback, and I just felt that, you know, lots of people wanted to ask me questions, including colleagues that I was working with in lobby about. It's difficult. It's difficult to manage that when you've got a story of that scale that's unfolding.
Do you remember how long you turned your phone off for?
I think a couple of days. I think I went down to my parents. They live on the south coast. And I just turned my phone off, didn't take calls, took a couple of days off work. It just, yeah, it was a very intense period in the aftermath.
And you said it's usually lots of calls and that's how you get leaks. Have you ever had experiences where you basically did feel like an MI6 agent?
There have been surreal moments. I remember once meeting a contact in Speaker's Yard, which is where all the cars pull up for PMQs. And they just handed me this giant bump of information. And it was about, you know, 200 pages long relating to a government policy. And it was extraordinary. So sometimes it is that. Sometimes it is walks in the park with phones off, all of that. But most of the time, it's just talking to people and trying to gather as much information as you can.
You just heard about the Chatty Rat inquiry. But there have been so many other leak inquiries with equally ridiculous names. Hunts to find leakers are an absolute speciality of Westminster. The leaker is very rarely found, and the whole thing can quite quickly descend into a farce. One former CCHQ boss told me the whole idea of a leak inquiry is not to find the leaker, because what on earth do you do then? Another expat told me what it was like going through a leak inquiry when something was leaked about their boss. The whole thing sounds absolutely wild. What they described as a quasi-criminal inquiry saw them asked to submit their phone, their records, their accounts. The line of questioning was fairly robust, they said. The whole thing, they said, was a mix of stressful and laughable. That inquiry, you'll be shocked to hear, never found the leaker.
So we've written recently about Sue Gray over on the Labour side is already instigating her own leak inquiries in a bid to keep her troops in order. So I can kind of see the disciplinary benefits, but I guess it's up to them what they do. But I will defend resolutely our right to pursue what's actually going on out there and to try to find out the truth of what's happening and what people are saying. And their leak inquiries won't deter that. And they certainly haven't ever stopped people from talking to me, and they haven't stopped me from talking to other people.
I mean, people do them in different ways.
James Schneider again.
A lot of it is in part for show, because you're trying to stop there being future ones. I mean, I know, for example, I ran one after the first National Committee meeting of Momentum, where all of the papers from the meeting got leaked to the Telegraph while the meeting was still ongoing. And, you know, I conducted a leak inquiry not to actually find out who had leaked it, but in order to make it far less likely that the next meeting's papers would get leaked. So, you know, you say that all future documents have all been multiply watermarked and have little errors in them for different copies and have different metadata so they can be traced, not all of which was necessarily true, but you use that process in order to reduce the likelihood of future leaks.
Okay, so we've heard about the factional leak and Steve Swinford's murder on the Orient Express style of collecting them. You know, where he puts together lots of different pieces of information from a number of different sources. Now let's explore the legitimate or authorised leak. It's something James Schneider admitted to doing in his role as head of comms for Labour.
An authorised leak is a tactic which can be collectively agreed. So, yeah, I would do the odd leak in that way, which would help land a story better, because it's more interesting to have some particular exchange or some legal work that's been done for the party that hasn't been given to anyone else, that sort of thing.
We see a lot of these authorised leaks in the run-up to fiscal events. Ministers and officials hand out a few stories to friendly journalists to kite-fly and test the waters before the policy is officially announced. And let me be clear, this is not how it's always been. If you look back to 1947, for example, then the Labour Chancellor Hugh Dalton mentioned a few key details of his budget to a journalist literally as he strolled into the Commons Chamber. When this made it into print, he immediately resigned in horror. I think we can chalk that one up as an accidental leak. Back in 2024, so much had been leaked in advance that when we got to the budget, there were really no surprises left. Even Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's key announcement of a 2p national insurance cut had already been leaked to, well, you guessed it, Stephen Swinford. So, that's what it's like to be leaked to and to publish leaks. But to really understand, to get inside the art of leaking, you need, of course, to hear from the leakers themselves. After the break, we'll do exactly that.
If a politician has a dark secret, then I would suggest that I'm not the person to come to.
Obviously, we didn't meet publicly, but he would give me documents.
Stay with us. For a period of several months last year, a woman was waking up every morning, putting on a disguise, and walking into a newspaper office undetected. She walked past colleagues and friends, but no one recognised her. Every single day, she walked down flights of stairs to the basement and entered a room without any windows and barely any ventilation to work on a top secret project.
The computers we worked on weren't part of the network. Everybody was offline. Nothing was taken in and out of that room.
This is Isabel Oakeshott, journalist, author and master of disguise.
All of our work was kept in a safe at the end of every day. I've never worked on anything with that level of security. No one was allowed into that room. I'm afraid not even the cleaners, which meant that pretty rapidly, actually, it became pretty disgusting. There were sort of bits of food lying around, and ironically, quite a few people went down with COVID during this operation. Not really surprising when you've got no ventilation.
The irony of people catching COVID was because the team were working on the lockdown files. This was an investigation based on 100,000 WhatsApps from former Health Secretary Matt Hancock to find out more about the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Oakeshott effectively leaked the WhatsApps to the Telegraph after Hancock had given her access to help write his book.
I mean, I'm a very prominent lockdown skeptic. I wanted to get absolutely to the heart of the story. And I hoped to get as much from Matt Hancock, who had been the health secretary at this pivotal time, as much as I could to get it into the public domain. And that is what we did. I found him really great to work with. And I was able to encourage him to put a lot in that book, you know, a huge amount from the WhatsApp communications that he shared with me are actually in the book that we wrote together. But there was such an enormous volume of material. If we had had time to go through it all, he probably would have agreed for a lot more of it to go into the book.
And then at what point do you decide to hand that over to The Telegraph?
So it wasn't really until after the book had been published that I thought, what am I going to do with this extraordinary cache of material? My initial thought was, I need to send it somewhere safe. You know, perhaps I have a friend who lives on a very remote island. He can keep it there marked, you know, don't anyone look at this for 30 years. And it wasn't until I had a conversation with a good contact of mine on The Spectator, a very private, confidential conversation in which I said, look, I've got this material and I want to write a piece for you, but I can't use it because I've signed an NDA. And my friend on The Spectator said, well, hang on a minute, this just has to go into the public domain. That was a pivotal moment for me.
Do you remember that first meeting with The Telegraph?
Well, the first meeting I had with The Telegraph, I was actually taken into the building via a back entrance. It was all very cloak and dagger. And the very senior person from the Telegraph could see straight away the value journalistically of the material that I had. I showed him some examples of what I'd got and these files. And he was immediately extremely excited. And things moved pretty fast after that.
But was that a difficult decision after you'd been working so closely and, as you say, had a good relationship with Matt Hancock while writing the book?
Of course it was. Of course it was. Because, you know, I liked Matt Hancock. I got on with him. I respect him. We had worked really effectively together, by and large. And for the vast majority of the project, we had worked well together. And it would have been nice not to have had to do it in the way that I did. But realistically, he was never going to say, let's share this entire dossier of material with a newspaper. And I took the view that it was overwhelmingly in the public interest to do so.
Not surprisingly, Oakeshott faced enormous criticism for the breach of trust. Hancock himself was livid, but she insists it was the right thing to do.
This is so important. You cannot, as a credible journalist, sit on a file like this of historic importance because you signed an NDA with a politician. We are not here as journalists to protect politicians' dark and dirty secrets. Sure, we can protect some things, but if it is in the overwhelming national interest, or indeed if it's a matter of national security or the UK relations with the US or so on, sorry, but that has to be put out there. That is our job. And if we're not in it for that, then I don't know what the hell we're in it for. I'm not interested in being part of some little cozy club in which politicians are friends with journalists and journalists are friends with politicians.
Do you worry that you won't be trusted in the same way by politicians in the future?
Well, let's put it this way. I haven't been short of work since then. I carry on doing what I do. And if a politician has a dark secret, a really dark secret, then I would suggest that I'm not the person to come to, because if it's in the national interest, then I'll expose the secret. But if they want to build a relationship of trust in which they're exposing someone else's wrongdoing or a matter of huge importance relating to someone else, then work with me.
Do you have any regrets about how you handled it?
None whatsoever.
Were you worried about legal repercussions? Are you still worried about legal repercussions?
Never.
A spokesperson for Matt Hancock said, for Isabel Oakeshott to claim she leaked Matt's WhatsApps because it was in the public interest is laughable, given the independent UK COVID-19 inquiry already had them. What's more, they said, she got stories wrong, having relied on partial information with no right of reply, something that IPSO, that's the Independent Press Standards Organisation, is currently investigating. Now, look, Oakeshott said she's not worried about repercussions, but leaking is not without risks. Take whistleblower Edward Snowden, for example. He is still holed up in Russia after fleeing the States because he revealed the scale of surveillance by the US National Security Agency. Over here in Britain, in 1983, a young Foreign Office clerk, Sarah Tisdale, was jailed for sending the details of cruise missile deployment plans to The Guardian. And more recently, Tory MP Damian Green was arrested and nearly charged himself after helping to leak Home Office secrets. The year was 2007, and he was Shadow Home Affairs Minister.
I had been contacted by a Home Office official who said there's a real scandal happening inside the Immigration Department. The government is putting out false facts and they know they're false. And he gave me documents that proved that to be the case, and I handed them on to newspapers because that was the way to expose them.
The stories were mostly about immigration statistics. One of the documents revealed that thousands of illegal immigrants had been given clearance to work in the security industry. The official in the Home Office was Christopher Galley. After he contacted Damian Green that first time, they struck up regular contact.
We didn't particularly try and hide it. Obviously, we didn't meet publicly, but he would give me documents around Westminster, sort of in the tube station, things like that.
Were you then just kind of leaking them to journalists and saying, this is important, there's a scandal going on, you need to see this?
Yeah, absolutely. You can assess the strength of the story and whether it's just an opposition trying to embarrass the government or whether, oh, no, this is really serious stuff. And it was quite serious stuff. It was front page stories in tabloid newspapers sort of level.
But then
I had a phone call saying, very, very urgently, phone your office, because I wasn't in the House of Commons, I was at a meeting somewhere. And the office said, we've got the police in here, they're trying to find you. So they had by then, I think somebody had told them where I was, so they arrested me.
Green was arrested on the 27th of November 2008 for aiding, abetting, counselling or procuring misconduct in public office.
I was brought back to London and put in Belgravia police station's cells, where the party found me a solicitor very quickly and sent one along. But yeah, no, I was interrogated in Belgravia police station for hours. I was never charged with anything, but the offence they were talking about was misfeasance in public office. In theory, it could be life imprisonment.
While Green did leak some documents given to him by Christopher Galley, he maintains there were no national security risks to these. Unfortunately for him, though, simultaneously, other serious security leaks were coming out of a government department. Green denies involvement with those.
These were politically embarrassing leaks for the government, but there was no security aspect to it. There were simultaneously, as it happened, serious security leaks from inside parts of government that absolutely should not be leaking. And the two investigations got confused. And so I and the civil servant involved both ended up being arrested. It went on for several months, clearly with the police realizing that they'd made a mistake, but as with all institutions, not wanting to admit it. And in the end, the Director of Public Prosecutions decided that in the public interest, I should not be prosecuted. That DPP was one Keir Starmer. So respect to him for that. He behaved obviously sensibly. You know, you cannot have a country where you go around arresting opposition politicians for embarrassing the government. But presumably knowing at the time he wanted a career in the Labour Party in the future, nevertheless, he took the right decision.
Do you regret leaking things, or do you feel like you made the right decision?
I mean, I regret being arrested. It was a very, very uncomfortable time, and it took 5 months before Keir Starmer said there was no case to answer. That was quite a horrible time, but you know, what was exposed needed to be exposed.
Was there any way of getting away with it without anyone knowing it was you?
Well, not really, because I was appearing in all the stories. I was the Shadow Immigration Minister. So if the Shadow Immigration Minister is commenting on a series of stories that embarrass the government about immigration, it's not very difficult to find out who's behind it.
Green leaked the Home Office secrets in 2007. Sitting in his parliamentary office 17 years later, he's sanguine about the fallout.
Ministers complain about leaking, and it's like complaining about the weather. It's something that will happen. You are in charge of an organisation which may have thousands of people in it with a variety of political views, some of whom will not necessarily be on your side. And 'twas ever thus. and I suspect always will be. So what ministers should do is make sure that they are not putting themselves in a position where a civil servant could embarrass them by revealing that they're not just bending the truth, putting the best gloss on something, all the, you know, things that you expect politicians to do, because in the end you are trying to make yourself look as good as possible, but actually distorting facts or indeed denying facts. That's when I think it becomes really serious, and that's when it's obviously easier to justify the leaker at that point. There's the, you know, the interesting question is, when does a leaker become a whistleblower? And it's often in the eye of the beholder.
Do you feel you and Christopher Galli were whistleblowers?
Yes. Wrongdoing was happening that ought to have been exposed.
So, that's the art of political leaking. There are plenty of reasons for people in politics to leak. Accidentally, honourably, and all the rest. Sometimes a leak may look like a leak, but it's not. It's a handout. Or, if Stephen Swinford is involved, it's the result of 30 to 40 calls that have successfully pieced a mystery together. Mostly, they come from a conversation over a drink or a WhatsApp. It's bad for government when things are being leaked, but good for democracy. And let's face it, great for journalists. And there's good news for leakers too. You're not likely to get caught red-handed. Most leak inquiries result in no further action. But even for those who are out in the open, including the leakers who spoke to me, seem to have no regrets, even after their brushes with the police and disgusting airless officers. This week, the news is dominated by a leak about a Conservative Party donor. Who knows what leak next week will bring? And as we crawl closer to General Election Day with its high stakes and tension, perhaps we'll see more players and parties in Westminster becoming leaky sieves. Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider with me, Aggie Chambray. If you've enjoyed it, please spread the word, follow us, and maybe leave us a nice review. We absolutely love love on social media. My X handle is at Agnes Chambray. And don't forget, you can go back and listen to old episodes like mine from a couple of seasons ago on the dark arts of politics. But before you go, as always, I have my wonderful co-host Sasha O'Sullivan with me. Sasha, welcome.
Aggie, it's great to be here, and I loved that episode. I was, in fact, late to the studio to record this chat because I was so engrossed listening to it.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
And I do think if anyone wants to suddenly hand over big dossiers of documents to either of us, this is your bat signal.
I very much endorse that message. Sasha, what have you got coming up next week?
Right, so next week we are talking all about polls. Obviously, every week we hear how far behind Rishi Sunak is, how far ahead Keir Starmer is. So I've done a kind of poll of pollsters.
Oh, well, that sounds great. And I genuinely can't wait to listen to that. So that'll be in everyone's feeds next Friday. My producers this week were John Rogers and James Tyndale of Whistledown Productions. And here at Politico, my editor is Rosa Prince. Sasha will be back next week.
See you then.